and welcome to this podcast. This is Professor Gordon Moran from the University of Nottingham.
And I'm Professor Maurice Gordon from the University of Lancashire in Preston.
And as you might have guessed, this is a podcast focusing on the BSG-IBD guidelines that have just been published in GUT in 2025 in June, just after the BSG meeting. The aim of today is for us, for myself and Maurice, to discuss really the methodology and the finer points about the guideline, and we hope that this will be useful to you.
We especially hope that we're able to perhaps give the insight and meat on the bones that allows you as the users from hopefully a variety of stakeholder backgrounds to be able to take the best from the guideline. Because I think it's fair to say, Gordon, that whilst on the surface it may look similar, actually as our readers delve in, I think there will be quite a lot of areas of divergence from previous guidelines, not just from the BSG, but perhaps from other societies.
I think so. And sort of, obviously, we're a bit skewed in this because we've spent the last 2-3 years doing this. So we've got a very deep understanding of how we did it. But even to the uninitiated, I think looking at the present BSG guideline, but perhaps and comparing it to the previous guideline from 2019, and you can see a different methodology and a different style in how this guideline was generated and delivered. Well, I guess, Maurice, I don't know, this probably is something we should pick on and sort of discuss a bit more in detail. A question that I keep getting asked, and I ask myself as well, what is the major difference really between this guideline that ourselves have worked on and the previous guideline, I mean, an excellent guideline that our colleague Chris Lam had worked on, and as well, but taking it across to the ECHO guideline and the AGA guidelines, what's the major difference between us and them in methodology?
So you are right to ask the question, because on the surface, it doesn't look obvious necessarily what the difference is, particularly as I think it's fair to say all of the guidelines now embrace grade. And so we can agree that compared to 10 or 15 years ago, every guideline is different because of that embracing. And so when looking at this difference, outside of that surface level point, they may seem similar. And I guess where we've perhaps pushed the needle is we've been fortunate enough to have the support of the BSG to fully embrace grade from the perspective of those who are leading the way methodologically. So our friends and colleagues in the international grade community, in the grade working group, in the McMaster units under the leadership of many people, including the father of evidence-based medicine, Gordon Guyatt, and Holger Schönerin, who's really, I think, the embodiment of that moving forward. And you'll recall we were lucky enough to take many members of the guideline group over to Amsterdam a few years ago to get individualized training on grade. And so it's probably evolution rather than revolution of the use of grade. And I would suspect that the key changes we've made will become par for the course for future societies. And if I was going to put it into 3 or 4 bullet points, it would be the use of grade as a game of two halves, and that is primary systematic review done for the purpose of the guideline so it meets all the specific goals, because that matters. And the second half being the grade of the recommendations, and that line is often blurred, and we made that line very clear, and I'll explain if you want what the difference is later. The second is the use of thresholding. And this is something that grade has wanted people to have for a long time. It is moving past the idea of statistical significance alone, which is arbitrary at 5%, and saying, well, actually, for this particular outcome in this particular setting, what would be the threshold that matters and makes me use or not use this therapy? So as a simple example, the thresholds for side effects of a severe nature, such as mortality, would clearly be different than the thresholds for success for a secondary outcome, I don't know, quality of life. So for quality of life, a difference of 20% you may deem in your clinical practice as one that's very significant. I might deem 40. We might be able to agree. But I think we can both agree that if that threshold was morbidity or mortality, that threshold would be much lower for us to have concern about a treatment. So this process of thresholding for the individual treatment is prescribed by grade, but often isn't done. And I think the final key point I would make of difference was the use of network meta-analysis, and perhaps a use of it in a way that, again, we felt was balanced and we felt matched the best expectations of the grade community and hopefully for the society represents best practice, not as a replacement for standard systematic review and meta-analysis, and not to best it, but instead as a complementary tool to clarify and triangulate when things are complicated. So that in essence is where I think we are different, but I don't want to overstress the difference in some negative way. I suspect this is a journey many are on.
No, I agree. So what I like as well is and I'm glad you've mentioned the thresholds, because I think historically we've always assumed for one reason or another that around the difference of 10% is different between arms. And if you like, even if you, for instance, you look at non-inferiority trials, usually the difference is between 9 and 11%. So regions around the 10%. But as you say, I mean, clinical remission is one thing, clinical response is another thing, endoscopic remission is one thing, and histology, for instance, is different. You've picked up on mortality, which is completely different. So I think the thresholds differ based on what the disease is like. Is if the intervention is there to decrease mortality in metastatic malignancy is completely different to inducing remission in bio-naive IBD. So I think we shouldn't really be using the 10% across all the most cases. So I think this is certainly useful, and I hope that the piece of work we've done nationally and internationally with our colleagues in Canada and ECHO will help inform future guidelines and future trials. What I find, I guess, this work perhaps might need a bit more refining, because we've done it for IBD, but we haven't done it for Crohn's or UC specifically. We haven't done it for induction or maintenance. We haven't done it for bio-naive and bio-exposed separately. So I think it's a bit of work that needs a bit of more refinement perhaps down the line. What do you think?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think to your first point that the 10% it is used, although I think you may have been a little bit too kind in some ways. There are many guidelines that exist that don't use any form of threshold. The threshold is statistical significance. And this has come up many times, for example, in my work with Cochrane, confusing how significant a result may be of a tiny magnitude. So if you've got a very significant result of 1% difference, there are reviews and indeed guidelines that use those reviews that would not differentiate that to a difference of a threshold, as you state, 10%. But you're right, many do use that. And I think coming to your point of what we didn't do, I guess that I would say is the ambivalence I have of both the great strength and the great weakness of how we deployed this for the first time in a guideline. We didn't just ask the GDG, which had, you know, almost 100 views, which was, I thought, very, very useful thing to do to reach consensus. And there was good consensus. But we triangulated this with several other countries to make sure that we had some basis for this. So this, I think, is a great strength. The weakness, of course, is with this approach that people can argue, well, that's not true to me. And that could be very personal. It could be them as a clinician, it could be them as a patient, or indeed it could be their context. So I think there's a need there for a future piece of work, not just for the BSG, but in fact, for others, and this includes primary researchers, of course, and clinicians, to say, okay, if we're going to have to embrace this idea of threshold clinically mattering and move past statistics alone, surely we should have some sort of consensus. And whether that has to be per condition, different outcomes, different countries. And that would be somewhere, I think, that needs to be done before any update. So outside the scope of what we've done so far, what do you think?
No, and I'm glad you mentioned statistical significance, because I think there's the perhaps understanding in the uninitiated that statistical significance is clinical significance, or is the minimal clinically important difference. But no, that's different. If you can get statistical significance of 2% between two arms, if the numbers are huge and the standard deviation is not too big, but is 2% clinically significant? Is it significant to you as a clinician and a patient when you're giving a treatment? So I think I'm glad as a GDG we made a distinction between those two.
Well, and you mentioned a patient, and that's really good timing, because early on Friday, Gordon Guyot sent a tweet that the concept of minimally clinically important difference, the MCID, which those who have had the pain of having to do a sample size calculation will be familiar with, has changed to minimal important difference, because they acknowledge that there's something paternalistic about us as clinicians dictating. So the concept of a minimally important difference includes, as you rightly said, not just our views, but actually in partnership with our patients. And if they have very different views about what difference they would expect to perhaps take on the burden or the risk of a certain treatment versus a, we need to know it. And this might be at the heart of so many treatments that perhaps are not embraced, or we have poor compliance, or even aren't popular. So yeah, I think there's a really important bit underneath a lot of the findings in the key recommendations that will be different for the reader. But I hope that context helps them to understand why that we think is a big positive.
I agree. And I think the thresholds really. So, because if you think about it, if systematic reviews are systematic reviews, the evidence is there and published, and you think that all national societies should come out with exactly the same suggestions and recommendations, is it? Because at the end of the day, trial A gave a signal of efficacy for drug B, and that's across all the board. So why should our society give a different suggestion to a different society? But I think that's down to what our society thinks is clinically important or is important. So I think that gives a distinction and an ownership of this data to that specific society.
Well, and that might link in beautifully to one of the other changes in terms of the application of grade in this guideline. We embraced something called the evidence to decision framework. And this is to help you guide us at that concept of the two halves I discussed, the evidence which is graded on the one side and the separate part of how you make a decision. And the evidence to decision framework moves past the evidence alone. It's never the only factor. Many other factors matter, such as local context, local patient preferences. This could include social, religious, it could include cost. We know that the qualies and the nice calculations in the UK will never match what happens in other countries. And same with expectations. So that combination is something we've reflected in our process. And unfortunately, due to word count in the guideline, or maybe fortunately for the reader, they are in a massive bumper supplement that almost doubles the already 100,000 word guideline. But you'll see in there detailed discussions and presentations in these grade tables where you have that context and access to these evidence to decision frameworks. So you can see perhaps why something where the evidence says A, the recommendation says B. That's never a problem if the local context says that's needed. So a simple example may be that if you're in a given culture where certain foods are not acceptable for religious reasons, suggesting that that's a therapy to use when there's an alternative may simply not make sense.
Or perhaps in other situations where certain advanced therapies are not available, then suggesting against using tiopurines or, for instance, 5-ASAs in a certain setting is not viable because other options perhaps are not available. So I think there is a certain element of uniqueness to a societal guideline. But I think something we haven't picked up on really is the networks. I mean, did we really need to do the networks? At the end, other societies, for instance, haven't done them. They've used published systematic reviews, layered on any evidence past those systematic reviews and made their suggestions and recommendations. We felt networks would homogenize all the present data. But as well, I wonder what you think. If trial A says something, is the network superior then? Or is the indirect evidence counteract the direct evidence or not? What do you think, Maurice?
So what I actually think is, essentially, if the networks are done right and interpreted right, they are superior. But the superiority is because they almost always will reinforce the messaging from the direct evidence. Where consternation comes is when networks say something juxtaposed to the primary or review evidence. And in my experience, having done quite a large number of these NMAs now, and again, pushing the envelope methodologically, is when you look into the detail, that's often because of the misuse of the technique. And actually, in one point, what is that major misuse? It is prioritizing ranking. Well, I think everyone who knows even a little bit about NMAs, the ranking alone over the certainty of evidence. I've mentioned systematic review a number of times. It's a separate part to making grade recommendations, but you do grade the evidence, this two halves concept. You have to grade a network. So if you have a top ranked therapy, but you have no grading, anyone who reads it would be led to the belief that that is the top. If you're top in the class for your maths exam, you're top. If I said you're top, but just to be clear, I'm 99% sure that you as the top student cheated and therefore it's an unfair result, Do you think the second student would be happy to accept that, or the third or the fourth?
I like the way you've described it there. I think that's very clear.
And so from a network standpoint, the grading, which includes all those other factors more than the magnitude, it includes all those other factors such as how certain we were from the perspective of heterogeneity, how much all these different trials are saying different or the same things. If they're all saying different things, I have doubt, and you should have doubt. That's what grading does. If the result's not precise, you have doubt. You should do. Grading does it. So what we've actually found, I think in most circumstances here, when you compare the networks to the direct evidence, they often reinforce the same message. And that's how we use them, as complementary, not as replacements.
And I was going to pick up on that. To be honest, looking at the results from the networks, they really haven't said anything that was surprising. If anything, the networks, and which then linked to the suggestions and recommendations, actually gave opinions that most of us already practice. They didn't say, don't use drug A, or we shouldn't be suggesting you not using drug B. And we all said, oh, no. We use this drug all the time. It's not the case. Actually, if anything, the NMAs did enforce or give a number to what we already know. So I think it felt very, very comfortable.
But that leads to a rhetorical question, which is, why did we bother? And I think the answer is, because when you look at those who perhaps discuss in the literature, or when you go to meetings, or indeed other guidelines, without networks, what you will often get is trump carding of evidence over evidence, yes. Not from individuals, but from practice. So you may have a systematic review that says A is stronger than placebo and everyone is convinced of it, but...
Exactly.
And they say something else. And that but is very hard to argue with. So actually, that ability to take, I think the best example is advanced therapies, but we've used them, for example, in the very recent guidelines looking at colorectal surveillance for IBD with my very, very, very lovely colleague, James East, who I had the pleasure in co-chairing with, just like yourself. And we used it to look at not just treatment, but actually surveillance methods, the different types of methods available for surveillance. It similarly was useful for a different context. But in this review and in this guideline, I think for the advanced therapies, it was the primary focus. They stood out very strongly. And I think there are several examples when the discussions were held amongst the GGG day to day. A question was raised in good faith. The data was available and it was able to acknowledge and respond with fact to allow the appropriate decision. Didn't make the decision for people. But yeah, I think that's the answer to that rhetorical question of so what? And I hope that's why others will use this combined approach, with the only disadvantage being it is relatively resource intensive the first time you do it and you bring the network up to speed. But I hope that's a helpful view for not just yourself, but also for the listeners and hopefully for the readers on where the difference is here, not just difference for the sake of difference, but why they might matter.
And I guess it begs the question or the argument, do we sort of need a living guideline here? But again, that's a discussion perhaps beyond our discussion today. But doing a network every 5 years is hard work, while having this constant living and informing national and international guidelines, I think would make this job far easier than what it is. But I guess that's a discussion to be had on another day.
Well, I can give you my short thoughts, but they are just my thoughts on that point. A living guideline is, for those who don't know, basically became very popular amongst COVID because it's when the evidence is changing rapidly. And I think advanced therapies are changing rapidly. And it allows you to keep up to date for the reader. It's very, very fortunate for that. But there is another advantage behind the scenes, and it's the point you allude to. People may believe, if they're not methodologically doing this, that it's hard to do it constantly. Living guideline, regular basis, updating the evidence. For those of us who do it, I don't think it's the case. We know it because when we take a review that, let's say, we're updating for publication after 6 months, the job of updating a search, then updating a new paper, then updating the manuscript and the analysis is much easier than waiting 3, 5, 7 years. And the other thing you find perhaps with guidelines internationally is you tend to get, when people move on and a new team starts, that knowledge, that mountain you have to climb starts again and it's got bigger. So I think there is an argument, not for the BSG, but for all societies, to look at what the role may be for this in certain contexts. Is it something I would do for, say, the research for pathological classification systems in IBD?
Probably, exactly.
Not. But for this context, another one, if I give an example we're working on now, is EOE. The research in EOE, we're about to instigate a living guideline because there are 30 more RCTs than 4 years ago. when you're moving that quickly, it makes sense clinically, it makes sense for the patient, it makes sense for the policyholders. But as you say, I think that's outside of the scope. That's the thoughts of two chairs. But certainly it does tell you that we haven't found the process in any way painful. Rather, we found the pain was worth the gain.
And I think there's an element of institutional memory that gets lost, as you've alluded to. So I think making this living to an extent, it's rather than recreating the momentum every 5 years and having to teach people how to do this. Yeah, you'll have a core set of people who know what they're doing. So makes this, to an element, not a doddle, but much easier than what it could be. But I guess something perhaps that we should touch upon today in our discussion is, fine, we've discussed the guideline here, but what did it really inform? What are the summary suggestions, recommendations from it, and I guess departure from previous guidelines? You think that's something we should be?
That was what I was thinking as a listener. Yeah, if I was going to ask you for sort of a top handful, maybe not a top five, but a top bullet points of what you would say, these are the points to go to as the reader, the first things I know you'll be waiting to see, or your friend or colleague might have said, oh, this is interesting. What would those be?
That's a great question. And probably if I summarize these, and let's start with Crohn's disease, which can sometimes be a bit tricky to treat. And looking at the previous guidelines, we did hear Chris Lam et al. Say, well, we shouldn't be using 5-ASAs in the treatment of Crohn's disease in the induction and maintenance of remission. And we've supported that. But I think we've gone a step ahead and as well included purine analogues, i.e. azathioprine and mercaptopurine. And we're not suggesting using these as monotherapy for the induction and maintenance of remission in patients with moderate to severe Crohn's disease. And I think I need to highlight a couple of things here. Here, one is the distinction between suggestion and recommendation, Morris, that perhaps you could be better placed at explaining the difference, because there's some drugs that are suggested, some are recommended for or against. What is the difference here, Morris?
So they aren't, you're right, they aren't random words and they shouldn't be used as pieces of rhetoric lightly, and they certainly shouldn't be used as tools for the guideline committee to give their opinions. What they should be used for is clear tools following a objective and standardized process to mean something different. And so effectively, in simple terms, a recommendation or recommended is the replacement for what used to be called a strong recommendation. They are recommendations whereby the instigation using the grade approach is so clearly needed, either for or indeed against a therapy, that we would expect most, if not all, people to be taking this advice, and exceptions to almost not be occurring, as well as new research being unlikely to change it. Suggestion is very different. Suggestion would be something that would be an option and a discussion point for many, if not most, patients, but it would be something where we'd be expecting both departures in practice to happen on a minority but frequent basis, but also change could occur and indeed would occur. And if I give you an example, we don't expect, using our clinical acumen, anyone listening, that the view of steroids as a tool for induction in certain situations is likely to change from a research standpoint. We don't think it's likely that people are going to tell us that the side effects we saw didn't exist and they were made up. Both of those things are probably facts that are going to stay. And so a recommendation based on those facts is likely to sit at that level. However, if I take a relatively new advanced therapy that has two or three trials, even if there's incredibly strong evidence, I think there would be a significant hubris and lack of humility if any clinician or researcher, indeed patient, felt or led others to feel that this is the bee's knees, will be forever. No research will ever best it or change it or change our understanding from 2-3 years of evidence from 2 or 3 trials. So if I may consider our esteemed editor-in-chief of Gastroenterology Journal, who was also the head of Cochrane Gut with myself acting as a satellite for many years. So I clearly respect his views. He has said countless times at our Cochrane symposias at DDW that they wouldn't expect many, if any, treatments ever in Crohn's and indeed colitis to be anything other than a suggestion. Because if you look at what you knew as a clinician 10 years ago, if you look at what a patient knew from their lived experience 10 years ago, is it the same for most therapies as it is today? And the answer is no.
In fact, there's not many drugs that are recommended, really. And a case in point is mesalazine and ulcerative colitis. I think there's 41 or 51 trials we have referenced in the BSG guideline. And yes, it is recommended in the induction and maintenance of mild to moderate UC. Why? Because there's a lot of trials out there, and having another trial probably will not make a difference. They've been embedded in standard care in UK and international practice in UC for many, many years, and we know they're safe, they're effective, and they're available. So it's sort of, that's the sort of setting we're looking at here. But I think taking us back to the therapies, I think we did say that we were not suggesting the use of purine analogues as treatment for induction and maintenance in moderate to severe Crohn's disease, but that doesn't mean to say that if your patients are already on purine analogues and doing well, that you should just go and stop them. We are certainly suggesting here that there should be a discussion between clinician and patient. And if you feel that, and the patient feels that the therapy is working and it's effective and it's not causing side effects and everyone is happy to continue it and it's working, then you should. All we're saying is, routinely, this shouldn't be the go-to treatment.
And if I could give a methodological view on that, because I think that could feel counterintuitive to some clinicians, and hopefully, I think it's fair to say patients would be listening to this, and it may feel counterintuitive. My simple view is this. The reason why both those things can be true is, when we don't recommend something, it's often not because it doesn't work. It's often because it doesn't work necessarily with the magnitude or the side effect profile that we would want. And it clearly works for some people, otherwise the question wouldn't exist. So if you take someone who is already stable without side effects successfully on a treatment, you've now got a retrospective decision. You know that they were in that minority that yes. It worked. So it's a very different question that exists there. And it's perhaps why there are some very nicely written recommendations in both the setting of ulcerative colitis and Crohn's for the withdrawal of certain therapies, immunomodulators and biologics, which is something that I think have been updated quite clearly in this guideline compared to the other. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the difference there is, so and that's, I'm glad you mentioned it, the difference that we're not suggesting using tauopurins for the induction and maintenance, but then we're not suggesting stopping them if they're working. The difference there is, in the induction and maintenance data, there's a relative triviality in efficacy, but as well, there's a high incidence of adverse events, with around a quarter to a third of patients not actually being able to tolerate these drugs. Hence, the signal of the intention to treat analysis is negligible. If you take it forward, though, and stopping treatment, hence speech patients, have already tolerated these drugs, so they've been self-selected to a cohort who already have accepted these drugs, then you can start seeing that the signal of efficacy is a bit stronger. Why? Because patients have tolerated it this time. So you're not negating that effect through adverse events. So hence, that's why we're saying if they work and they're not harming, then there's a reason not to stop them.
So before we move on, can I ask you a question that again, thinking from a patient standpoint, that I've had actually asked to me by patients when I've done research work. And that is, if they are in a meeting with one of their clinicians and they take the guideline, and let's say they took one of these points, might not just be this one, any of them, and they said, because of this, we are suggesting your therapy stops now, and really a patient feels the choice is being removed, what would your response be in that situation to maybe reassure our patient? Should that be happening? Should people be saying, if something isn't recommended anymore or suggested, it should be stopped immediately?
No, I think and again, this is goes down to the detail. So, at no point did we say not recommended. And if a drug is not recommended, that's when we should say, listen, you're on this drug. This is not recommended anymore. We should stop it. We're saying it's not suggested, which means overall, we're not suggesting using this in this setting. But if in this specific situation, a patient tolerates it, then we should. So I don't think, no, we should be having an audit against the BSG guidelines and anything that is not suggested or recommendations, the patient should stop. I think this needs to be an individualized patient discussion. So unless there's a problem with safety and absolute lack of efficacy, I don't think we should be routinely stopping treatment. No, I think the discussion should be had, an informed discussion should be had, and then a decision brought forward between the patient and the clinician.
And I think that point of a negative statement being different to not a statement at all. So there are some where we've simply not made a statement. Perhaps newer therapies, evidence is available. It's not the same as a negative. And
exactly.
A negative suggestion is as open to the clinical variance we discussed. Now, the exception, as you beautifully lay out, is a negative recommendation. In those cases, there'll clearly be justification made in the text as to why that's there. And like the positive recommendations, those we would probably expect, although they're exceedingly rare, for the reader to take heed of, would you say?
Yeah. So like, a negative recommendation, for instance, just to make it clear, would be the use of methotrexate in women of childbearing age. That definitely we do not recommend. So if you are a woman of a childbearing age or a person of a childbearing age and getting pregnant, then methotrexate certainly should not be an option. And that's this not recommended. The others are all not suggested. But I think if we take this on as well, the fact that we're not suggesting thiopurines for induction of maintenance of remission in Crohn's disease as first-line therapies, which links us nicely with the work from on Profile from our colleagues Miles and Nuru from Cambridge, where we've shown efficacy of induction of induction and maintenance of remission with TNF therapy. So I think linked both together, we're now suggesting top-down advanced therapy. So as we're suggesting using advanced therapies straight away as the suggestion for the induction of maintenance of remission in moderate to severe Crohn's disease. So I think here we start to see the triangulation between direct evidence, indirect evidence, historic evidence, and expertise on how to treat Crohn's disease. So rather than routinely step-up therapies, I think we're going a step ahead here to go down with top-down advanced therapies straight away to help patients immediately.
Now, Profile just managed to sneak in, as it were, before our evidence deadline for the guideline, and I really am glad you brought it up. You've explained it beautifully. How much on the ground do you feel that that relatively up-to-date and perhaps forward-thinking statement or recommendation will change things for practice? Do you feel this is already happening in most places, or do you think this will signal and perhaps initiate a shift in current UK practice? I wonder what your thoughts are as a clinician, essentially.
So I think to an extent, it is already happening that patients are going on advanced therapies earlier and earlier and earlier rather than been sitting on thiopurines. And nothing against using thiopurines, but if there's objective evidence that the thiopurine is not working, then there's already quite a norm practice nowadays to go straight away to advanced therapy. So I think this suggestion is going to endorse that practice. And perhaps to the people out there who are slightly less comfortable in doing IBD, perhaps they do other stuff, not just IBD, then this is, I think, a sort of suggestion to, yes, let's go ahead with that and start using these sort of therapies before using thiopurines. But again, we'll need, this is not just a BSG discussion, this is a discussion, again, with commissioners, with the ICBs, with NICE. So I think, certainly, this will hopefully set the ball rolling for a change in practice nationally.
Well, I suppose that leads me on to what other items, if any, you think may signal a change either towards or perhaps slightly shifting against any other therapies within this version of the guideline.
I think one thing that attracted a fair bit of scrutiny and discussion was the suggestion not to use vedolizumab for the induction and maintenance of remission in patients with moderate to severe Crohn's disease. But I think if we unpick this, and I think this was a beautiful example where we could see the direct and the indirect evidence working well together, where we could see the thresholds in action. We had decided a priori, before we saw this, what our thresholds for triviality should be when it comes to remission and response. We already had decided what quality of evidence we were looking for. And after the networks and using direct and indirect evidence together, I remember discussing this case at length and looking at, okay, what is the efficacy of, for instance, of vedolizumab for the induction of remission? And that's 8.7%. And we had decided anything less than 10% will be trivial. So, and I think, if I take it back to you, and I'm just looking at the great table for vedolizumab in moderate to severe Crohn's disease, and we've got trivial and trivial for remission and response, small for maintenance of remission, trivial for in the reducing loss of response.
These are the magnitudes of
effect. These are the magnitudes of
effect. Yeah.
Exactly. So when we give a suggestion against a drug, it's not because one line of one outcome, let's say efficacy, was trivial. It's when you look across the board. And so great at the end, it's still a decision of an expert consensus by a group, but it's looking at the data presented both direct and indirect. So I think we made a collective decision based on everything presented to us. What do you think of that? Morris. I think that is a perfect example of how the methodology worked.
Well, I agreed. Going from a up-to-date, brand-new, high-quality, peer-reviewed and published Cochrane review, explicitly for the job with the direct evidence, all the direct evidence, with all of those extra bits that Cochrane adds on, which is nice. Contacting the primary authors, getting missing information, missing risk of bias. It allows you to make sure you get your best version of the truth as it stands, then going into the network to allow you to compare and contrast to see if that does shift the needle at all. And in fact, as we discussed before, it reinforced most of the magnitude and the certainty data. Then to go into discussion and this, I think, relatively new realization to those on the guideline committee that we can be highly certain that the best form of evidence possible, the strongest version of evidence of a trivial impact, not of no difference. It'd be easier if there was no difference to understand it, but to have a impact that's proven, but of a trivial by whose setting? By ours, by what the thresholding did. So yes, that conclusion's there. Now, to be fair though, as we discussed beautifully about recommendations and suggestions, it's an example of a suggestion. If the future evidence pushed the needle and that magnitude shifted ever so slightly, it would change. And I also think you could probably comment on the implementations there, because there are clearly exceptions that the team wanted to talk about, didn't they?
Exactly. And I think we're not saying do not use vedolizumab. Certainly, if there are patients already on vedolizumab and there are thousands and thousands using vedolizumab in Crohn's disease, and if these patients are doing well and the patient is happy, clinician is happy, objective endpoints have been reached, certainly do not stop vedolizumab in that setting. And there are certain situations where patients with comorbidities, elderly patients, where vedolizumab is the ideal treatment in that setting for moderate to severe Crohn's disease. So we're not saying we're not recommending it, we're just not suggesting in the wider community. But there will be certain situations where it should be. And for instance, just taking it forward, we have a section on advanced therapies for post-surgical Crohn's disease. And there, the direct and indirect evidence did suggest the use of vedolizumab for the maintenance of remission, in maintenance of post-surgical remission. So there are certain situations in Crohn's disease, for instance, post-surgical and perianal, for instance, perianal Crohn's disease, where vedolizumab has a role. That suggestion against was specifically for luminal disease in the wider setting, not in specific considerations. But I think as well, there will be other things that we should be mentioning, but what do you think?
I was certainly interested. I mean, I think the example you give there of vedolizumab having different recommendations in different settings is actually an important one, because it points to complexity. And I think perhaps one of the hardest things when reading a guideline is embracing complexity. Do you think, and maybe one of the criticisms one could make is because of how complex the methodology now is, and we would argue not by choice, but because that's the right tools for the right job, do you think that's going to be a barrier for wider use of the sorts of issues you're discussing for the reader or the clinician? Or do you think it's something that in the medium to long term will be an advantage?
I don't think it will be a barrier. I think we've paid great detail in the guideline, especially when we're presenting it and the way it's been presented within GUT, to actually make it a very clear guideline and make it very clear to understand for the reader. But there's as well transparency in the guideline. So I think if you really want to know exactly why a drug is not suggested or recommended, you can look at the grade table, but you can actually work your way back to try and understand why a decision has been made. So I don't think it should be a hindrance to the reader. I think it supports the reader, and the reader can go into as much detail as they want to try and understand the decision that's been made. So I think it's quite well laid out. But I guess another point of divergence, for instance, is in ulcerative colitis in this case. I mean, we know there's three anti-TNFs in ulcerative colitis, but are all anti-TNFs similar? And we use a lot of infliximab in the UK, but what about, for instance, adalimumab? And adalimumab is another drug that is not suggested for the induction and maintenance of remission in patients with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. And again, I think this is a beautiful example of how our methodology has worked. And if you look at the magnitude of effect in the gray table, we start seeing 6.3% for clinical remission, small signal for response, but then there's no data for maintenance because this was a run-through trial rather than a randomized trial. But I think when we took that direct and indirect evidence together with expertise from the group, and I remind the audience that the GDG was made up of 100 people, then we felt that we should not be suggesting adalimumab in the induction and maintenance of remission in UC. And probably this is not, doesn't come to a surprise. But again, if your patient is on adalimumab and doing well, and you've scoped them and they're fine and there's endoscopic healing, the patient is happy, no, don't stop the drug. It's a very cheap and accessible drug. So, but to the wider audience and to the wider patient, probably this is not the drug we want to start using for advanced treatment straight away. But again, there will be implementations and considerations in specific settings where this would be the ideal drug to use, but not for the wider population.
Well, I mean, you moved on beautifully to ulcerative colitis, and I guess I was going to ask on behalf of the listener, I think when we look at previous guidelines, not just from BSG, the last round, but perhaps other societies, ulcerative colitis, when it came into advanced therapies, was a relatively sparse landscape compared to Crohn's.
Yeah.
I think we only had two or three with recommendations of any form in the previous BSG guideline. Has that been an area of shift in this guideline?
There's many, many, many more therapies in this guideline, and which I think adds to the slight complexity in delivering this guideline. And even now that this guideline has come out, there's more therapies that have come out, and there unfortunately are not in this guideline because things move on, which take us back to the need of a living guideline. But I think, yes, this guideline has a lot of newer therapies, and there's a lot going on for it. So I think it should be there. It should be very helpful to the reader of this guideline. I think it should inform on what is suggested and recommended in the treatment of Crohn's and ulcerative colitis.
Okay. Are there any other areas then that you would highlight to the reader? I think you already touched on the post-surgical, where there was a shift with advanced therapy. Is there anything else that stands out that you would highlight for them to take away from it?
So we did mention the post-surgical, and there are other areas where data is limited. And yes, they didn't lend themselves perhaps to great recommendations because data is limited. But in that setting, we did a good practice statement. When, for instance, perianal Crohn's disease is one of them. We had used in this setting, we didn't do our own networks. We had used a recently published evidence synthesis by Vib Jairat from Canada. And there we made the suggestion that infliximab should be our first line therapy. But there's a cadre of second line therapies that we suggest. Again, evidence is slightly lacking in this case. So we had to use a good practice statement. But as well, there are other settings where, again, evidence is a bit lacking, but it's very, very important to the community. So for instance, pregnancy in inflammatory bowel disease, how to manage IBD in the setting of pregnancy, not stopping, for instance, routinely anti-TNFs in patients who are pregnant, what drugs and drugs not to use in the setting of IBD and pregnancy. For instance, co-diagnosis of spondyloarthropathies with IBD, therapies that are useful in both settings. So I think there's quite big sections there that are outside the networks and the great recommendations that are of very good use to the reader, because all of us see patients with IBD and spondyloarthropathy. All of us see people who are of a childbearing age who have IBD. All of us see patients with perianal Crohn's disease and need guidance on how to treat this. So I think there's a lot. Anemia in IBD, for instance, or fatigue in IBD. Now, these are sections that perhaps the evidence is lacking. It's slow to grow, so they will not change between one guideline and the next. But certainly we felt a need to try and provide some good practice statements to the gastroenterologists out there on how to treat these complications in inflammatory bowel disease.
And you've just mentioned good practice statement, which I think is a good point to make that is clear in the guideline, and indeed it's previously published operating procedure and protocol. One of the approaches that this guideline takes is to have a eclectic and inclusive view of how recommendations or statements can be made in a guideline. Grade for interventional work clearly is the epitome for both making and indeed refuting therapeutic interventions, but there are settings where it's simply not appropriate. And you mentioned good practice statements. This would be when the direct evidence is insufficient, but there are other sources. And of course, the best one, you mentioned our lovely 100 GDG members. If you have, including patients, views that are absolutely insurmountably clear and for a good practice statement, one of the other stipulations is there needs to be a clear, actionable net consequence from the statement. They are appropriate. I don't think our guideline pretends that they are the same. I also don't think it pretends they are less important. It's about the right tool for the right job, working as a cohesive set of tools. And I hope the reader will see that difference, because the example sections you give, apart from anything, I think are incredibly beautifully written digests on the topic that are really accessible to anyone from a first-day diagnosed patient through to an expert stakeholder, perhaps a relative, friend, parent of a person with IBD, all the way through to trainees and indeed expert clinical colleagues, IBDologists. And I would, someone like myself who's not clinically pretending or even purporting to be an expert in IBD, I took a lot from them and supporting them. And I hope you agree they would be something we would direct people to.
I do. And as well, to remind the readers that there is a patient-facing guideline as a supplement to our present guideline. This was delivered in collaboration with Crohn's and Colitis UK and patients. So there, this is as well a guideline that is specifically for patients. And I think this is the first time this has been done by the BSG in IBD. So this is really aims to translate the wording within the guideline, but still keeps content and detail to make sure a discussion can be had in an informed manner. And I think we've been talking quite a fair bit, me and yourself, Maurice, which reminds me that all our discussions, when it's me and you, Maurice, we never shut up and we keep on talking and talking and talking. And sometimes we do have to say, time is up. But I think we've given this a fair play. I think we've gave a nod to the methodology used, why and when, the difference between the BSG guideline and methodology settings and other guidelines like the AGA or ECHO or the previous BSG, what are the highlights and suggestions and recommendations and the wording within this present BSG guideline. I hope now that the listeners have a bit of more clarity on what the BSG IBD guideline entails and contains. Any other take-home messages, Maurice, you want to give to our audience?
Only other than to point to, as you just did, the supplements. They're often ignored in papers and I think sometimes seen as a secondary part. This is not the case here. For space issues and the decision to have a universal single guideline, which is unique to the society as a major international guideline, means that that choice was made. You pointed to, I think, Appendix 2, which is an excellent appendix, which is essentially patient-facing summary, and a lot of effort went in to do this. All the extra grade tables, these aren't just statistical material for the statistical enthusiast. They are genuinely helpful supplements with lots of material, and I would ask the reader to consider, if they want some meat on the bone, to use them. And I also would like to say thank you to the Society for giving us the opportunity to speak to our brilliant Society members and, of course, listeners of this. And we hope that the guideline can do what all guideline producers hope it will do, which is to have impact for everyone who deserves the best impact with IBD. So thank you so much for their time listening and for your time with me today.
Yes, exactly. And I think you pointed out this was a humongous collective effort between the BSG, the GDG, which was formed by the BSG and ourselves. So I think it was a very big effort and sort of evidence of support by the BSG to help us deliver this guideline, and we thank them for that. But I think I'm hoping that the listeners will find this very, very useful, and probably will leave it at that. And thank everyone for listening, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.